all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Today we're bringing to our listeners a very interesting story. We have two great guests who are going to help us understand this issue. And it's a little unusual for us to have both guests on, so we'll see if we can pull this off without getting either of you interrupted. We're going to talk today about a report that the ACLU of Southern California issued earlier this year called Discharged and Deported, How U.S. Veterans Are Being Banished by the Country They Swore to Protect. First on, Jenny Pascarella from the ACLU of Southern California, the Director of Immigrant Rights. Say hello to our listeners.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're glad to have you, and I know we're infringing on your day, but we'll keep it moving. Jenny is a graduate of Barnard College in Georgetown Law and has been with the ACLU for 10 years or so. And we're also lucky to have on board with us today a Marine. He served for 10 years. He's currently a professor of practice in political science at the University of California, San Diego, Nathan Fletcher. Nathan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you very much for having us.
Well, this is a very interesting problem. Jenny, I suspect it started at your end, and Nathan kind of got involved once the ball got rolling a little bit. Tell us how this ball started rolling.
Sure. So, you know, I focus on immigrant rights at the ACLU, and about probably 2 years ago now, I got a phone call from a man named Hector Barajas, who is a deported veteran himself. He was a paratrooper in the Army during the first Gulf War and deported a number of years ago to Mexico, and he actually basically, in having been deported and starting to meet other fellow deportees, realized that there's a growing community of veterans like him who had been deported. And so he began taking people into his home, basically creating a shelter for deported veterans in his own home, which then grew to become an advocacy organization on this particular issue of veterans who've been deported. And so he reached out to us, basically seeking help, legal help, to help address some of the legal issues that the folks that he was trying to help are experiencing, and those are sort of two categories of things. One, the fact that people were deported and removed from the country that they, in most cases, the only country they ever knew, where their entire families live, you know, the countries that they served for many of them in times of war. And then the other issue being that as veterans, they aren't receiving their pensions and their disability pay that they're owed by the VA as a product of their deportation. And so those are the two issues he brought to us, and seeking, you know, legal assistance to help with the advocacy on that. And that's how we started to get involved. And ever since, it's been a real genuine partnership with Hector and his group to help elevate the issue and try to bring some legal attention to it.
Let me put some context around this for our listeners. And that is, again, some information pulled out of the report that the between 1999 and 2008, about a 10-year period, there are more than 70,000 undocumented immigrants who have enlisted in the armed forces, and less than half of those folks have managed to gain citizenship. And when you start looking at the percentage of non-citizens in the current active duty military, it's about 4%. Many of those folks come from the Philippines. I think that's the leading country, then Mexico, then Jamaica, then South Korea, then the Dominican Republic. So this is not just a one-country problem. And the report also tells us that there are about 608,000 foreign-born veterans. I suspect, Nathan, when you were in the Marines and in Iraq during your 10 years of service, you met some of these men and women.
Well, we did, and what was interesting about it is how rarely it came up, because the underlying premise of the military is that you're all equal, you're all the same. You know, your race doesn't matter, your gender doesn't matter, how rich your parents were doesn't matter. You all took the same oath, you wear the same uniform, and you have the same commitment. And that, I think, strikes really to the core of when I first heard about this. I said, well, that can't be true, because you get citizenship in a time of war if you do one day of service. And, you know, there would be Marines who would offhand say, oh, no, I became a citizen, you know, when I joined, the recruiter mentioned this to me. And so I just thought it was something automatic that happened at boot camp, and was really shocked and appalled to realize that you're taking, you know, people who were, you know, we win the lottery of life if we're born here. But even if you're not born here, since the founding of our country, if you've been willing to say, I will give my life for this country, then that country has been willing to give you citizenship. And it just seems like the greatest injustice I've heard of, that we would take these super citizens and not even give them citizenship and deport them and take them away from their family and their benefits and the things they're entitled to.
Well, they certainly are super citizens. There's a lot of discussion in the report, but also just in general reading about how foreign-born soldiers or lawful permanent residents really serve with distinction and recognized at the highest level of the military. Maybe we can turn to our ACLU lawyer here. And, Jenny, can you explain to us why this is so darn confusing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you pointed out, it's a historic fact that non-citizens have always played a significant role in our military. Laws around that have some, you know, changed over time, but one core truth has been that if you serve in our military, you are eligible for citizenship. Much of that is true because in order to enlist in the military, at least nowadays, you have to be a green card holder, a lawful permanent resident. Generally, lawful permanent residents are eligible after a number of years to naturalize, but there are specific provisions in our law that give special privileges for naturalization to people who serve in our military, which, you know, should be sort of an obvious principle that if you sign up to go to war or you sign up to serve our country, that you should have an expedited path to naturalization. The problem has been that people have not been given adequate information. Often they've been given misinformation about when it is that they are entitled to naturalization and whether or not when they take that oath of enlistment during basic training, that makes them a citizen. In fact, many of the folks that we've interviewed, and we've interviewed over 80 deported veterans, told us that they thought that as soon as they took that oath of enlistment, that made them a citizen. And that was reaffirmed by their military chain of command, by their recruiters. And that's one of the greatest tragedies here is that, you know, you would think that it should be true that all that you would have to do to become a citizen is take that oath and actually serve in our military. But in fact, the law doesn't reflect that. It reflects that you still have to file an application. You have to follow the application through. You have to go through various bureaucratic steps to complete that process. And until very recently, the government did not assist service members in that process. And in fact, it was generally, in many circumstances, almost impossible for somebody to complete that process while they were serving in the military because they'd be stationed overseas and they wouldn't be able to follow the paper trail and appear for interviews, et cetera. And so, you know, that's one of the saddest components of this situation is that for so many of these men, they would have applied for citizenship if they knew that they needed to, but they were told that they didn't. And so only after they get out of the service and, you know, one thing leads to another, they find themselves in deportation proceedings. They realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm not a citizen actually. And then, you know, by then it's too late to correct the problem.
And you point out in the report that confusion is reasonably based if you just look at the oath that's sworn in at time of service and the oath to become a citizen. I mean, I read them side by side and said, well, yeah, I see where the confusion comes in. It's a reasonable thing for people to be confused on.
Yeah, absolutely. The oath is basically identical to the oath of naturalization. And so, yeah, logically, you know, it makes sense. Somebody would think that when they swear their, you know, raise their right hand and take that oath, that they de facto become a citizen at that moment.
Nathan, I suspect when you were in the service, you had an experience similar to mine, which was, you know, the service helps you out on certain things to keep your affairs in order, not the least of which is to make sure you have a will when you're going overseas and going into harm's way. I don't know if that was your experience or not.
Well, it is. I mean, you think about it, you join the military and they managed to not only get you a will and a power of attorney, they gave me 27 different shots for every conceivable thing known under the sun. They took my height, my weight, my vitals. They gave me a checkbook. They gave me a class on how to use a checkbook. They gave me a bank account. They literally stripped me down naked and gave me everything I need to go through life. And I think if we all told up everything that we got, this is a process of joining and going through MEPS, the Military Entrance Processing Center, and boot camp, there's probably 1,000 line items that somebody checked to make sure that we were ready to enter active service. And it just strikes me that a country that has the capacity to put a man on the moon 40 years ago, or a country that can launch a cruise missile from thousands of miles away with the precision to hit the second floor window and not the third floor window, that already has a system in place for probably 1,000 checklists to enter the military, can simply add one that says make sure their damn citizenship is processed, because that's the promise we made to them when they joined.
Did anybody in your research find a reason why that step on the checklist isn't carried through and the service doesn't assist? I take it by the silence, nobody found a reason why that didn't happen.
I think in a lot of cases what we've heard is just that. There was either confusion, they were told you're automatically a citizen, or, you know, some form was filed, it was lost, it was gone through the process. And, you know, I think it's probably hard for a lot of folks to really understand the you know, in the military, when you're commanding officer, when you're a recruiter, when these folks tell you something, you believe them because that is the chain of command. And so it's an incredibly powerful thing for a young private to be told, look, you don't need to worry about this. This is fine. And so, you know, if that's what they're told, that's what they're led to believe, then why would they not? And who would think that they wouldn't be awarded that? And, you know, I suspect some of them probably knew there was something that needed to be done, but weren't quite sure what. And again, the burden shouldn't be on, in my opinion, the burden shouldn't be on the service member. It should be on the service, the branch that benefits. And by the way, on this point, Jenny mentioned that they've always served, and that's true. In the report, you can actually read General Peter Pace testified before Congress that non-citizen veterans perform better, across the board better, than their citizen counterparts. I mean, these are not only just your average citizens. These are folks who do truly heroic things. Here in San Diego, we had someone awarded the Navy Cross. I mean, you know, these are some of our finest military members.
So we get them through service. They serve honorably. They're going to be honorably discharged, but they exit the system without being naturalized. Is that the right word? And made citizens. Is that sort of what happens at that point of the process?
Yeah. So, you know, and one thing to clarify is that I think as this issue has gained attention, the government has taken steps to try to correct some of these problems to ensure that non-citizens are not leaving the military without having the opportunity to naturalize. So they now have a program in basic training that helps walk folks through that process, and the idea is that people will be leaving basic training having already completed the naturalization process, and so they should be leaving basic training already sworn in as citizens. It's not clear to us, like, how, if, you know, I assume that program has been effective, but there isn't good data about, you know, is everybody benefiting from it? Are folks still slipping through the cracks? But before they instituted that program, it's definitely true that, you know, far, far too many non-citizens were entering the military, and in many cases under these sort of false promises that they had already, you know, by joining the military, automatically made them a citizen. And so, you know, they serve however long they serve, and then they get their discharge, and they're still not a citizen. And then, you know, and therein lies the problem, because, you know, as we know, our government has you know, fail to provide. This is sort of another aspect of sort of the services due to service members and veterans, but to help folks reenter civilian life. And for many folks, they struggle in that transition. And you know, a lot of the folks that we've talked to among the deported veterans crowd, you know, really struggled with drug addiction or alcohol abuse. And all it takes is a conviction, even for, you know, otherwise considered minor drug possession, to then land somebody in deportation proceedings where there's no discretion available in the law, and it basically deportation is mandatory. And so that's how this happens, is, you know, a person picks up a conviction, even for something quite minor, oftentimes related to their directly related to their service, and there's no discretion. It's mandatory deportation, which is a banishment for life from the United States.
So let me back up. I think we've talked many times on Veterans Radio about the reintegration problem and how, whether it be PTSD or MST or TBIs, often moral injuries, oftentimes veterans have self-medication issues, whether it be drugs or alcohol. They may be having problems getting their disability recognized by the VA, and then they run into problems with the law because they're doing those sorts of things. It's in that context, based on the problem with the law that they might run into, they might get charged with, and I think it's an aggravated felony that triggers this, or at least the law changed to trigger this idea that one offense can result in deportation of these veterans.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of that change in law and how that change and these definition of aggravated felonies took away the judge's ability and discretion on whether or not deportation is appropriate?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So this is changes that were made to the immigration law in the 90s, which expanded the categories of criminal convictions that made it mandatory for the government to deport somebody who is a lawful permanent resident. And it expanded it from, you know, what had started as, you know, a series of crimes that most people would consider to be very serious violent crimes, to a very large category of crimes, which is sort of, the term is aggravated felony, but that's really a misnomer because many of the crimes are not felonies and they're not aggravated either. It's just a catch-all to umbrella term to bring in all kinds of crimes, including drug crimes and even, you know, crimes for which people don't get, you know, sentenced to any term of imprisonment, such as like petty theft. You know, we have a guy, for example, in, among the folks that we featured in the report, who was deported for writing a bad check, which is considered an aggravated felony. So this category is enormously broad, and part of the thing that happened in the 90s with the changes in the law is that discretion that was otherwise available to judges and in the immigration court system to look at a person's history and weigh, you know, the different things that a person has in their life, you know. For example, they could weigh, you know, this particular conviction against the fact that the person served in the military and maybe that, you know, maybe that drug conviction was related to their service, and make a determination about whether it was fair and equitable to be deporting them. And instead, with the 96 changes in the law, that discretion was completely eliminated so that judges don't have that option anymore. And that's, again, you know, there's so many tragedies in these stories as we've interviewed folks, but another heartbreaking thing is when you look at the court transcripts and you see these transcripts of judges saying, thank you for your service, but I have no choice. My hands are tied. And it's just heartbreaking, and it shows just how punitive our immigration law has become in ways that really make very little sense. And I think you see that most clearly in the cases of veterans.
Well, I also suspect that if you dig deep enough, the underlying crimes have often been pled or tried maybe with ineffective counsel and haven't been moved to at least some of these maybe could have been moved to veterans courts, which around the country are popping up and seem a little more friendly to understanding the consequences. We're talking to Jenny Pascarella, of the Director of Immigrant Rights at the ACLU of Southern California, and Professor Nathan Fletcher of the University of California, San Diego. Nathan's a Marine, spent 10 years in the service, and comes at this not because it's a problem he's experienced, but a problem that he knows. You just don't do this to other veterans, do you, Nathan?
No, you don't. You don't. And I think most folks don't realize that this is an issue. You know, our country has a wide ranging of opinions on what we ought to do as it relates to a kind of comprehensive solution on immigration reform. But it would seem like what everyone can agree on is that those folks who took that oath, who were willing to give so much to this country, should be afforded to live in the country. And you know, one of the greatest ironies is that there is a path for these veterans to come back to the United States. They just have to die. Once they die, we will gladly transport their dead body back across the border. We will go to a military funeral where we will give them full military honors. We'll play the bugle. We'll fire the rifles. We'll fold the flag, and we will present it to their family saying a grateful nation appreciates the service of your son or daughter. We just wouldn't let them live here.
Yeah, this is just one of those idiotic things that happens in life. Jenny, I assume that these veterans may be entitled to health care because of their service, but they can't get it because they have been deported. And maybe they're entitled to disability benefits, but I don't know if they get them once they've been deported. Can you shed a little light on that as we bring this to a close?
Yeah, you know, these folks are eligible for to receive disability pay and to receive pensions. It's, you know, the law doesn't make any distinction about what your, you know, immigration status is or whether you're inside or outside the United States. However, there's a bureaucratic issue, which is that in order to access these services, you know, whether it's accessing, you know, the healthcare system that the VA provides or accessing the disability and pension system, it requires, at least in the disability context, that you, you know, receive an examination from a VA-certified doctor. And that's been a huge issue, is that the VA has not been responsive to these men. You know, we think there are thousands of them across the world, and helping them, providing them a VA doctor. What the men that we've been working with describe as this Kafkaesque situation, where they contact the VA schedules them for an appointment with a doctor in San Diego, for example.
Right.
And then tell them, we can't go to San Diego, we were deported, and then they get this runaround that doesn't get them anywhere.
Well, they'd close their file because they didn't show up for the exam.
We see that
happen with people here in the States all the time. It's a ridiculous situation.
Yeah.
It's one thing to just complain about a situation. What I want to give credit to the ACLU here is your report goes on and makes specific recommendations that VA, the president, the Congress should be implementing. Can you talk about that real quickly?
Yeah, you know, there's a number of things that can be done. I think most importantly, we'd love to see Congress step in and adopt legislation that would, you know, make clear that if you serve in the military, you become an automatic citizen. You know, the law should reflect what I think our country, you know, values, and I think that is a value that most people would share. But there are other things that the government can do, you know, short of legislation. For example, you know, our immigration system, our, you know, executive could say, we're going to put a moratorium on deportations of veterans. We don't think that we should be doing this. Our immigration system should reflect that, and we're going to we're simply not going to put them in proceedings. One thing that is really striking at a sort of very fundamental level is that our government, you know, in all of this, in all the ways in which, you know, they haven't been paying attention to this issue at a very basic level, when they initiate deportation proceedings, they aren't even screening people to make sure that that person isn't a veteran. They don't ask people whether or not they're a veteran in any consistent, systematic way. Not only that, they don't track it. So there's no actual data of hard, you know, concrete data about the numbers of people who served in our military who've been deported. And that's sort of a basic thing that the government needs to do in order to get a handle on this problem. But more than that, you know, they should be devising methods to ensure that people can remain in this country who have served in our military and whose entire lives and families are here. And we should be looking for solutions to bring all the thousands of people who were deported and really shouldn't have been deported. They should have been made citizens when they are in the military. We should be working to bring those folks home and reunite them with their families.
And Jenny, can you quickly tell us how one finds the entire report and how they track what you're doing and how they might be able to help? Do you have a website or an email address that you'd like to pass along?
Yeah, the ACLU of Southern California, you can find our report there. It's ACLU SoCal, so ACLUSOCAL.org. We've also created a campaign on this particular issue, and Nathan can give us the URL for that because I forget what it is.
Yeah, that one is you just simply go to deportedvets.com, and there you will – I'm sorry, deportedvets.org. And when you go there, we have a petition up. Just basically asking folks to just sign a simple petition and join the coalition in the effort. And then as we push these efforts at state levels in various states, at the federal level, as we do these things, we will keep people posted on kind of what we're doing and what we need them to do so that folks will join in helping us in each of those efforts.
Well, I want to thank both of you for bringing this important issue to light. I believe our listeners will have the same reaction I did when, which is, what the heck is going on here and how do we fix it? I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone, and it's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.